9 strikeouts and 3 2/3 for DeGrom, including the last 8 hitters.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're looking for fastball. They get it. They just never seen it this quick.
1-2 coming. He struck him out. 9 in a row for Jacob DeGrom.
That is New York Mets ace Jacob DeGrom throwing absolute gas against the Rockies this weekend. But what's even more impressive is that DeGrom is far from alone in his domination. Pitchers have figured out how to get their fastballs faster and their sliders nastier. And today, Jeff Passan tells us how they're all doing this and why a scientific revolution is now threatening the game itself. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, April 19th. This is ESPN Daily. Jeff Passan, I am looking at you remotely, and you don't have sleeves. What version of Jeff Passan are we getting today?
The gun show version, Pablo. You can can tell that I'm bringing the 27-inch pythons to the podcast today.
Jeff Passan is a baseball insider for ESPN and author of The Arm, a book about pro pitching. And he stopped chasing gains just long enough to talk with us.
And it's going to be Hogan-esque.
I feel like this isn't an accident. Like, did you show up to flex or were you doing something beforehand?
No, I was just working out. That's all. And I try to cram things back to back as much as possible. So worked out for an hour. I think I have pasta sauce on my face right now. Here we are talking baseball.
So I've summoned you here. I've intruded into your workout regimen because I want to talk about guns of a different kind. Because I watch baseball this season, Jeff, and it just seems harder to get a hit. And I bring you on as a man of reason and journalism and of science. What's actually going on here when you look at the actual numbers behind all of this?
What's going on, Pablo, is the culmination of the last 25 years where science and baseball have become one and the same. And when that happened, the inevitability was that pitchers were going to be the ones who benefited most from this. They were going to be the ones who benefited because they could figure out what was actually happening with the baseball once it left their fingers. They could figure out how to throw harder and how to maximize their bodies in ways that hitters simply can't, because hitting is a reactive thing and pitching is a control thing. And the result of that, because it is harder, Pablo, to get a hit right now in April of 2021 than it has been since 1968. So we're talking 50 plus years. The batting average in Major League Baseball right now is under 240. And what that means is that if hitters know that we're not going to be able to cobble together single, 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 and put runs on the board that way, if we're not going to be able to steal bases because it's mathematically disadvantageous, then we better hit some damn home runs. Guys are throwing harder than they ever have, spinning balls faster than they ever have, and altogether making themselves into human beings who could be mistaken as pitching machines.
I want to start with velocity here, I think, because back in my day, Jeff, like when we were growing up, the idea that a pitcher could hit 100 miles an hour, that was magical. It was mythical. It felt almost dangerous, but it feels like random dudes can do this now.
Pablo, it's not random dudes. It's like all dudes.
Swing and a miss, and that'll do it. 101 miles an hour.
Woo! 101.
See you later.
My goodness. Swings at that 102-mile-an-hour fastball and comes up empty.
You laugh, but if you go down to an average minor league complex, you will find 5 to 10 guys who can hit 100. They may not be able to throw a strike. They may be young, they may be older, they may be skinny, they may be fat, they may be tall, they may be short. There is no barrier, there is no impediment to throwing 100 miles per hour anymore.
Wow. Holy smokes, he made quick work of Buxton.
They're going to say, "What did you see?" And he's going to say, "I didn't see anything."
I'm looking right now at Fangraphs, and I'm just going to go down from the top relievers right here. The top 10 relievers. This is average fastball. 102.2, 100.3, 99.9, 98.9, 98.8, 98.6, 98.4, 98.4, 98.3, 98.1. Fastball velocities, Pablo, have turned into temperatures. Jacob DeGrom's average fastball this year is about 99 miles per hour. Sandy Alcantara, 98. Tyler Glasnow, 98. Nathan Eovaldi, 98. Gerrit Cole, 97.5. Corbin Burns, 97.5. I can go on and on and on about these guys who would have been, two decades ago, looked at like Nolan Ryan, and now they're looked at like just another guy.
So the average velocity at this point, as we enter, Jeff, what is the global warming of velocity here? Temperatures rising uncontrollably and possibly apocalyptically. What does the average look like? What's that number at this point?
Average fastball velocity in Major League Baseball is right around 94 miles per hour.
I mean,
I hate being that when I was growing up guy, but we you know, we're around the same age. We grew up around the same time.
Yes.
94 was a hard thrower.
Dude, like, that's mid-90s.
What we're watching right now in terms of pure pitch arsenal is the greatest that Major League Baseball has ever seen, and it's not even close. The stuff that's going these days would blow away Babe Ruth, would blow away Ted Williams, would blow away Mickey Mantle, would blow away Willie Mays. And I don't say that to denigrate the greatest players in baseball history. If they faced what an average major league hitter is facing right now, it would take them a year to figure out how to hit it. A lot of it goes back, Pablo, to training and to understanding what makes a great pitcher. And a great pitcher can be born, don't get me wrong, but a great pitcher can be built as well. And it is not just arm strength, it is legs, it is core, it is movement, it is explosiveness. It's the types of modalities that are specifically targeted for velocity.
What you're describing, Jeff, is extreme. Like, is pitching fundamentally breaking the game?
I'm not gonna go that far, but we're getting to the point now where it's fair to wonder, is this lab-created monster too powerful? When batting average is down, and when strikeouts are up, that means that the ball is not in play nearly as much of the time. And baseball's already a sport that teeters on the precipice of, to the average fan, of being boring. Mm. And that is a fair and that is a warranted criticism. Because it's just a game of catch between the pitcher and the catcher. It's almost like the pitchers out there have put on the infinity gauntlet and that they are almost unhittable and the game may not be able to rein them back in.
Jeff, it's one thing to have all of these self-engineered players basically throwing baseballs harder than we've ever seen before in human history on average. But it also feels compounded, this problem, by the chess game aspect of baseball in terms of what are these starters even being asked to do at this point and how that further makes life a nightmare for anyone who's standing at the plate.
I gotta be honest, starters aren't being asked to do a whole lot. When Shane Bieber went out there last week and faced off against Lucas Giolito.
Bieber and Giolito throwing blanks.
And Bieber threw nine shutout innings. It brought a tear of joy to my eye.
Shane Bieber has emptied the tank here tonight. He's got one more strike to get. Got him. What a night for Shane Bieber.
Jeff, you stopped shaking your fist at the cloud and wiped the tear away.
I have spent much of my life trying to avoid being the old man yelling at the cloud. But the reality is, this cloud is a cumulonimbus.
It's a rain cloud, Jeff.
That's it right. is. And it's dumping all over this game right now.
And then there are the guys, Jeff, who have mastered the technique in terms of how the ball spins and the sticky stuff they may or may not be using.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just spin rate in terms of RPMs, Pablo. It's spin axis. It's spin efficiency. It's taking slow motion cameras that capture your release at thousands of frames per second and seeing how a ball comes off of your fingers, going and looking in real time at the data and crafting, building the perfect pitch in a lab. And what they do quite often is they use, whether it's pine tar, whether it's a combination of rosin and sunscreen, whether it's stuff that I am not joking with you here, gets cooked up like drugs in a soda can or a beer can. Like,
wait a minute, that's actually how it is made?
Oh, yeah. Or a dip can. Like a dip can.
Wait a minute. Tell me about the Breaking Bad of all of these residues and how it's made. I want to know what's in the secret sauce.
There was a clubhouse attendant for the Los Angeles Angels, Brian Harkins. And Bubba Harkins was known for having the best sticky stuff in baseball. And it's called a Moda stick, which is, I believe, named after Manny Moda. It's like some rosin and some other, I don't know what Bubba Harkins had in his recipe. I don't know what pitchers around baseball have in their recipe. I've heard of a recipe that includes Coca-Cola. Like, I'm dead serious here that some guys allegedly use sticky stuff that has Coke in it and that it gets melted and burned with a lighter at the bottom of a metal implement.
Mm. Jesus.
I mean, and the thing is, they don't just do this for show. They do this because it really helps. And Trevor Bauer has spoken about this publicly. What it does is it adds hundreds of RPMs to the pitches that you're throwing.
If you spin the ball 2,000 to 2,200 RPM, if you spin it 22 to 24, et cetera, et cetera, look at the hard contact percentages, look at the swing and miss percentages, look at the averages and stuff like that. That's just on fastballs. The effects on curveballs and sliders have been documented as well. So that research is out there. But basically, if you keep the same spin axis and you increase the RPM of the ball just moves more.
So this is what the ultimate upshot is, Pablo. We have guys who have trained their bodies to throw harder than ever before. We have labs that have technology that allow these pitchers to optimize everything they're doing when it comes to spin rate, spin efficiency, making a pitch as perfect as possible, created in a lab like Dr. Frankenstein's monster. And oh, by the way, now you're telling me that guys can use stuff that technically is illegal to make those pitches that already have been optimized even better? It's no wonder baseball is in the position that it is right now.
All right, Jeff, after the break, I want to take a closer look at how those best of the best caliber pitchers are functioning in this environment. And I also want to find out what Major League Baseball can do to prevent this monster from consuming the entire sport.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Jeff, I want to get into some of the pitchers who are maybe guilty at the very top end of skewing the game in the way you've described. And you've reported a piece on Jacob deGrom that's on ESPN Plus right now. And you begin it pretty casually by just calling him the best pitcher in the world. And I just want to understand what makes him so clearly that.
And deGrom's first pitch of 2021 is a fastball in the inside corner at 99 miles an hour. Jake has become the hardest throwing starting pitcher in baseball.
It is the stuff.
And he gets it with a slider. Third strike out of the first four batters for DeGrom.
It is the consistency.
This is not the sweet science so far. This is just country hardball.
I mean, it's just triple digits after triple digits.
You know, honestly, I think part of it is a narrative in my head that Jacob DeGrom is defying what a pitcher is supposed to be. You know, there's this notion that as you age, Pablo, you don't throw as hard. And it's a notion because it's true.
I mean, that's just amazing. It doesn't happen for pitchers from 28 to 32, and yet here he is.
Because we have seen guy after guy after guy, after guy after guy after guy, after guy after guy after guy, go on that track. Jacob DeGrom, in 2016, was throwing an average fastball of 93.4 miles per hour. Had surgery that offseason. By 2017, he was up to 95.2. 2018, 96. 2019, 96.9. 2020, 98.6. Jacob DeGrom has gained, as he's gone into his 30s, 5-plus miles per hour over 5 years on his fastball. And he says he has done this because he has gotten rid of the mechanical flaws that he has. He has tried to perfect the way that he throws a baseball. And I'd say he's doing pretty well.
So, Jeff, what Jacob DeGrom is trying to do at this point in terms of trying to defy actuarial charts about retirement, where is he on all of this, and how reasonable is that aspiration?
He looks at starting pitchers like the NFL is starting to look at quarterbacks, where when you are the elite of the elite and you have the work ethic and discipline and desire to go late into your career, you are capable of doing that. And here's the thing. It's almost like a power pitcher is the quarterback who can throw the deep ball. And the ability to throw a deep ball tends to go away with most quarterbacks as time goes on. That's sort of how you know a guy just isn't what he once was.
Drew Brees basically stopped being able to throw deep and then stepped away from the game. Yeah.
Yeah. Jacob DeGrom believes he will be a power pitcher into his 40s. That's his goal. And it's an interesting one because you see so many power pitchers. I'm just going to look at this generation. Felix Hernandez was a dominant power pitcher. Vanished. Just went away. Justin Verlander, a guy who's been able to carry it into his late 30s, but ended up succumbing to Tommy John surgery. You know, there are power pitchers who can do it. And the one example that's clearly out there is Randy Johnson. You know, Randy Johnson was winning Cy Youngs in his late 30s and went deep into his 40s. Nolan Ryan kept that 9,800 mile per hour fastball, throwing no hitters into his 40s.
But they almost felt like the exception that proved the rule.
Oh, no question about it. They're the outliers. He believes he's an outlier too. Jacob DeGrom didn't start pitching until he became a Met. When he was at Stetson University, he was a shortstop. And the Mets picked him because they liked his arm and thought he could become a pitcher. And man, you want to talk about a good bit of scouting there. He ended up transitioning six starts into that year. He blew out his elbow. needed Tommy John surgery, and ever since then has been on the fast track to excellence, to greatness. And his desire isn't just to pitch into his 40s. He said, I want to be an Inner Circle Hall of Famer, which means he doesn't just want to make the Hall of Fame. He wants to be up there with Randy Johnson and with Pedro Martinez and Greg Maddux and Walter Johnson and the best of the best of the best. And he believes that that's something within his reach, even at 32 years old.
Jeff, that dream, that hope sounds admirable, but that just also must feel like a total dystopian future for anybody whose job is to hit baseballs for a living. Because now you have these guys who want to do this when they're like 47, and you have these older players, I imagine, who remember when the sort of tricks of the trade involved nail files as opposed to literal science labs. So within the game as constituted now, what are batters and managers and coaches, what are they supposed to do in response to this surge in pitching?
Emoji shrug. We still have Ronald Acuna Jr. hitting like 500 and looking like the best player in baseball. We still have Juan Soto, who, by the way, he's been flirting with 400, Pablo. I don't know if you've been keeping track, but
I have Google alerts set up for your future forthcoming record. Yes.
It's going to be, I've already started writing it just to prepare for it.
Another dystopian future of different
kinds, but yes. We have all of these great players who still can be great, which honestly speaks to their excellence that they're doing that in this environment. But what we also have is hundreds of other players who are trying to, as best they can, game the system. And you game the system by making up for the lack of hitting the ball into play by hitting the ball over the fence.
When there was a season that forced baseball to reckon with pitching the last time, we were talking about 1968. Uh-huh. And it was Bob Gibson and that 1.12 ERA. It was Denny McClain, who went 31-6. They lowered the mound 5 inches after that season had completed. What do you think we're in line for here in terms of adjusting the actual physics and regulations of the sport itself?
Well, it's not a surprise, Pablo, that Major League Baseball has asked the Atlantic League, which is an independent league that it's affiliated with and sort of serves as its science lab, to move the mound back to 61.5 feet from 60 feet 6 inches this year. Think about it. The pitchers who are in that league have calibrated their breaking balls to break in a particular way for a particular distance. And if you move the mound back from 1 foot, that is going to be an enormous change for them. You know, maybe the difference for a hitter between hitting a rocket and rolling over one.
So let's say I nominate you, Jeff Passan, with the job of fixing the game. Capital F, capital T, capital G. Like, baseball mostly seems to just want to get the ball in play more. It feels like that might be the goal. What would you do if you had that power?
Let me just start off by saying that this is not my idea. And I'm going to start off by saying that not because I don't think it's a good idea. It's because I think it's such a good idea that I don't want to be given credit for something that I did not come up with. You limit the number of pitchers on a team to 10 or 11. It seems really simple, right? What's going down to 10 or 11 pitchers going to do here? It's going to re-emphasize the importance of the starting pitcher. And it's going to do that because if you have only 10 or 11 guys, you can't bring the clown car of bullpen pitchers. It means that your starting pitcher better be able to go deep into games, because otherwise your bullpen is going to be worn down, and that's going to be a problematic thing. And the emphasis of the starting pitcher, Pablo, I think is something that's really important for the sport, for a sport that has a lack of stars already, to be able to turn to these guys and to say, this headlining matchup is not going to go away after 4 1/3 innings and 82 pitches. No, we're breeding guys to be workhorses. Beyond that, if efficiency is the thing that matters most to you, then maybe you're not going to go out and throw max effort. Maybe instead, you're going to learn to throw a sinker and try and get an early swing with weak contact. Perhaps you're going to be able to build yourself up to go 120 pitches by not throwing quite as hard. And there's the effect on the batter right there. The batters will be facing less high-quality stuff, and the less high-quality stuff you face, the likelier you are, A, to swing, and B, to put the ball in play and to have it have some actual impact on the game. Kills two birds with one stone right there. Those extra jobs that you would lose in the bullpen can go to the bench. You can bring players on, for example, who have great speed and have designated pinch runners who may at the same time have good tools but not skills elsewhere. They can develop in the big leagues. Oh, by the way, we have people moving on the bases now. We have more action. It seems like a very simple thing, but the effect that it has is far and wide, and to me would make a better baseball game, not just at the major league level, but down at the youth level, where right now, kids look, Pablo, at that radar gun and say, if I don't throw 95, I'm not getting a job. I think it solves a lot of issues with one very simple rule change. But we have been, Pablo, on this track for 20 years, and I just don't see anybody taking that step to say we're going to get away from that, because the reality is it's probably the easiest way to win. This, Pablo, was the inevitability of it all. Once you started going into a lab, once you started bringing science into it, you were always going to get to the point where it was at the cusp of breaking the game. And you wonder whether the keepers of the game are going to do anything about it, or whether they're just going to let nature take its course and have faith that the game, which has been so resolute in the past, is going to be strong enough to withstand this in the present.
Jeff Passan, thank you to you and your guns, by the way. Thank you for always making contact on ESPN Daily.
I'm going to go flex on you now, Pablo.
I can hear it from here. Up next, one of the most venerable records in NHL history comes crashing down, and Greg Wyshynski joins the show to tell us what it means.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. In terms of hockey immortals, there aren't many names that would go above Gordie Howe. Well, there's the whole great one thing, but that's a debate for another show. At the moment, the late Gordie Howe holds one of the NHL's most sacred records. But tonight, that record is set to be broken. So I asked our hockey hound, Greg Wyshynski, to set the scene. Greg, hockey season is winding down, and you are here to tell us about a record that is being broken tonight. So what is this record, and who is doing the breaking of it?
The record is for the most games played in National Hockey League history. It is a record of 1,767 games held jointly by the great Gordie Howe and by Patrick Marleau of the San Jose Sharks, who will play his 1,768th game against the Vegas Golden Knights tonight to set the all-time record. It took him 23 years. It took Gordie Howe 26 years with a major interruption in between for the World Hockey Association, where Howe played for a few years in the 1970s. And it's an impressive record. It's a record of longevity. It's a record of, obviously fitness, and a record of some luck too, in Patrick Marleau's case.
And it's a record that is owned by a guy who is famously one of the toughest people in sports history, Greg. I mean, Gordie Howe, for those who aren't puckheads, I mean, he's not only one of the greatest players of all time, he has a number of hockey records, and the Gordie Howe hat trick famously is a hat trick in which you get a goal, an assist, and also a fight in the same game. So compared to that dude, how does Patrick Marleau stack up?
Patrick Marleau would be like the last guy you'd ever expect to break a Gordie Howe record. Gordie Howe was famous. He is known as Mr. Hockey, but to his opponents, he was known as Mr. Elbows. Like, he would throw him around, man. He played a very physical, vicious style. And Marleau, by contrast, was once nominated for the Lady Byng Trophy, which is given to the NHL's most gentlemanly player. He's not a fighter.
I didn't even know there was such an award, Greg.
Oh, yeah.
There's an award that goes to hockey's grandest gentleman.
Yeah, it's all very Queensbury rules, but no, it goes to the most gentlemanly player. He's a low-key farmer's boy from Saskatchewan. And sometimes that demeanor has been confused for him being too laid back or too passive, both on the ice and off the ice. Some opponents have referred to him as being soft. Jeremy Roenick, a former teammate, once called him gutless on national television. So they couldn't be more different as players.
How does Patrick Marleau get to the point where he is maybe not, on the Jeremy Roenick side of the personality spectrum, but he is nonetheless an Iron Man?
He's really well respected. And you call him an Iron Man, he is in the midst of an 894 active consecutive game streak. So he definitely fits the description. His greatest attribute, besides being a fairly good goal scorer, he is right now 23rd all times in goals scored in the National Hockey League. His greatest attribute is his skating. He is a supremely fast skater. Former teammate Mike Ricci called it an effortless skater. He's avoided injury. He's played through, strains and stuff like that. He's also played through illnesses. Marleau said recently he used to get IVs in the morning if he felt flu-like to be able to play in a game that evening. Mm. He's also avoided catastrophic injuries like concussions through his career because he has that intrinsic quality that a player like Wayne Gretzky had. That's the comparison his former teammate Vincent Damfus made to me recently when he said that both Gretzky and Marleau had the ability to feel where the pressure was coming from on a hit and then avoiding it. And it's something you just can't be taught. And then on top of everything else, it's loyalty. He played 1,595 games so far in his career with the same franchise, the San Jose Sharks, a level where you're just they know you and you know them and the training staff knows you. To be able to play that long with one franchise during this massive number of games, I think has been a huge benefit for him as well.
But I imagine if you're going to play more games than any human has in the National Hockey League, there have to be some tricks of the trade. What does he do?
Well, one of Patrick Marleau's greatest quirks is his ability to get naked faster than any of his teammates. teams only have 18 minutes between periods during a game. Marleau is infamous and remains infamous for getting undressed faster than anyone in the locker room. One of his teammates told me it's like he's made of Velcro. He gets undressed so quickly. And then what does he do afterwards? He sprints over and he either gets into the cold bath, like the ice bath in the trainer's room, or he goes and takes an extremely cold shower. A lot of his teammates didn't quite understand what this was. He says that being in the ice bath helps trap your lactic acid. It helps you recover and build up your muscles. And there's science behind it. And he also feels like when he does this, he goes back on the ice and has more explosiveness in his skating and abilities for having been in the ice bath. So there is a method to what is clearly in the eyes of his teammates, some madness.
I mean, Greg, I know I just learned about the Lady Byng Memorial Trophy. I feel like the Patrick Marleau Memorial Trophy for the player who can get undressed the fastest feels like it's only deserved at this point.
Yeah, that's a completely different kind of streak, Pablo.
Greg Wyshynski, I have no way to top that. So thank you for being on ESPN Daily.
My pleasure.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.